Ali said before, this is a Betteridge law of headlines, that if in a newspaper you have a title with a question mark, the answer is always no. But in this case, the answer is I don't know. And I'm you know, trying to get some input from you. So this is an interdisciplinary workshop, which means it's very challenging because you know, you can speak to one community and then the other is lost, so you can speak to the other community, the first is lost. So I'm in a very privileged situation because my talk is equally unsuited to all members of the audience for reasons that you'll find out soon. Okay, so what is up here? So yeah, there's this logo of this conference here. You see this inflation. Relaxation, obviously developed mainly here in this city of Waterloo. And so hierarchies of necessary conditions for causal compatibility and causal optimizations have been proposed over the past years. And some are actually complete asymptotically. So if you, you know, impose all these conditions, at least for classical problems, you can then have necessary and sufficient set of conditions. And so for some time, we've been wondering, you know, can we prove completeness for the quantum version? And when I say we, then this is mainly Lawrence in the audience, he's a PhD student. So I have to apologize to Lawrence because, you know, on the first day he walked into the department, I suggested, you know, there are these dudes from Canada and they wrote out this hierarchy. Why don't you check whether it's complete? And then he didn't murder me yet, but it's turned out to be a very difficult question, but we're making progress on that. And so I want to report kind of where we are. And yeah, we propose to divide this question up now. I think that's our current understanding into two steps. And the first step is my talk here. Namely, I want to ask, can quantum causal optimization be expressed as a polynomial optimization problem? And this polynomial has a little star because it's not your usual polynomial optimization. It's kind of like a weird mixture of commutative and non-commutative polynomial optimization at the same time. And I will explain what that means. And the second question is, once I cast it in that language, can I actually solve that? And that is what Lawrence will tell you in the second talk after mine. Can these problems be expressed as an SDP hierarchy? And the answer is yes. Okay. So the guiding model of this presentation will be the bilocal scenario. When I flew here, I made a little explanation of what it all meant, but I kind of deleted it now because I have the feeling everybody knows what I'm talking about. Three parties, Alice, Bob, Charlie, they have inputs like settings. And, you know, pairwise, they share a quantum state. And we want to know what is the set of correlations that arises this way. Okay. And now what I want to do is I want to take this figure and cover most of it, except I will cover everything except for the A. And then I will slowly uncover bits and pieces. And as I uncover, I will tell you the kind of mathematical model I will be using to talk about these pieces. Okay? All right. So models of quantum. Here's the thing. So there is some. There's like two ways to think about quantum. There's like but two very famous ones. There's the textbook model of quantum systems where the primary object you associate with a quantum system is a Hilbert space. And everything else is downstream from that. It's derived from that. No, you can then get the observables, which are the operators, maybe Hermitian or something. You get states, state vectors, density operators. But the primary object is the Hilbert space. And since the late 1960s, there was this period in mathematical physics when people thought what you really should do is you should not start this way, but you should do take an algebraic approach to quantum mechanics, where the primary object is a star algebra A of observables. Yeah, so it's an algebra of operators, and star means you have some notion of conjugation of adjoint. And right, and so this is the primary object. And if you really want to have a Hilbert space, then often you can get one using the GNS construction if you're so inclined. But really, the idea is not to do that. You know, I'm not quite sure how I should interpret your face. You don't seem to be the biggest fan of algebraic quantum mechanics. See, neither am I like to stress. So the reason we'll be working here is not because I like it. I totally don't like that. Because the problem forces it on us. So if you want to talk about completeness of these hierarchies, you have to read these yellow books with scary titles, and it's a bit absurd because I don't know, like both Lawrence and me, we spent a lot of time reading, for example, this Blackadder book, which is very good if you want to learn about it, and it's kind of funny how we can now talk about, you know, weak operator topologies, you know. Yeah, I think it's funny. Anyway, so you have to deal with that. It's something that that does the problem forces on you, and so the two points of view are mostly equivalent. It mostly is a matter of taste. You know, the algebraic model is known to work better in the thermodynamic limit, for example. But for our, as I said before, for our approach, the second one is more natural and will take it. They're also only mostly equivalent. I'll come to that in a second. Okay. So now we know how to describe a quantum system. Namely, we choose an algebra of observables. Yeah, and because it's an algebra, they're not all Hermitian, so we allow for non-Hermitian operators too. Okay, so now we have to talk about quantum states, and right, so before a quantum state, you know, maybe if A is an operator, a quantum state would be a map that is specified by some vector psi, and you would map the operator to its expectation value. But now psi is from the Hilbert space, and we just got rid of the Hilbert space, so we have to talk about it in a way that does not refer to these wave functions. And so the way this is solved, it's easy actually. So a state rho is a linear function on observables, mapping observables to expectation values, and it has to have two consistency conditions. It needs to be positive. So if I evaluate a state on an outer product of operators, A star A, then you should get a positive number. That's a positive operator. States on positive operators give you positive numbers and normalization too. Okay? So now we know what a state is without using the word Hilbert space. All right, let me continue to disabuse you of the notion of a wave function. Aha, now comes the critical part, or like a critical part. Of course, many people have spent many years discussing this part, and it was also presented in the conference here before. Namely, how do we model locality? And locality in the textbook case is very easy. System A gets a tensor product, gets a Hilbert space. System B gets a Hilbert space, and the joint Hilbert space is a tensor product between the two. But we don't have that. So now, if we have a tensor product, then all operators acting on one tensor factor commute with all the operators acting on the other tensor factor. And so we use that as our axiom and saying subsystems are associated with commuting subalgebras. Yeah. So here are the observables of Alice, here are the observables of one half of Bob's system, and all observables from the one set should commute with all the observables from the other set. Now here is a point where the two approaches are not actually equivalent. So this axiom is fulfilled by tensor products, but the converse is not true. That was, of course, an open problem for a very long time and has been decided in the negative a few years ago. And so when I'm adopting this definition of locality, this model of locality, I'm actually broadening the class of correlations I'm allowing for. And so, yeah, there's a bit of a discussion whether I'm doing a relaxation here or not. I want to maybe, you know, cast some doubt on this. I think it is not clear. So we have two different ways of modeling locality. And maybe people in quantum information, they think the tensor product one is more natural because they grew up with it. People in algebraic quantum field theory, we think this is more naturally because they grew up with that. What kind of youth was that? I don't know. And and it's just unclear which one is more physical. It doesn't seem to make a big problem, difference in practice. That's why it was a long-standing open problem to decide whether they are the same or not in the first place. But they are different. Okay. I don't really want to talk about this anymore. I'm just adopting this model of locality for this talk.
And what's your point of view? Which one do you think?
I really don't know. I really, really don't know. I've not actually read a bit of these algebraic quantum field theory things, and I always said, oh, in algebraic quantum field theory, they do it, but I never knew what that actually meant. Now I know it a little bit, but I have no. I mean, their program also kind of failed, no? Because they promised, the physicists, they would write down things that don't make sense, and then came the mathematical physicists, and they would clear it up, but they can now say more clearly why quantum field theory is inconsistent, but they can't solve it either. So I really don't know. I think it's I have no idea. Okay, so now I can tell you what the bilocal scenario is. So it's an important slide now because I will now state the problem. The quantum causal compatibility problem in the bilocal scenario. So input is a conditional probability distribution, or maybe these are parameters. I'm not so sure anymore after the talk 2 days ago. These are like observed outcomes of measurement outcomes A, B, and C of the parties given inputs X, Y, and Z. So that's all classical data. And we assume that, or maybe data is the wrong word. I mean, we assume that we have a precise knowledge of these distributions. And they are compatible with this picture. And now I have to translate that picture into math. Okay, so what do we have? First, we have with every subsystem here, we need a subalgebra of observables, and they should all commute. And you see, okay, so there's one is the algebra of observables by Alice, one by Charlie. They are kind of easy, but Bob's observables, they have to be divided into two subsets, namely the subsystem that receives the message shared with Alice, and the subsystem that receives the message shared with Charlie. All right, so we got four systems and hence four commuting algebras. There is a joint state, so rho is these are sigmas, and here I'm talking about rows. That's because Lawrence did the figures, and I was so stupid to change them from sigma to rho. So that, like, sigma is rho for the purpose of my talk. So there's a joint state, and the joint state factorizes. If I put anything from A and BA in, and anything from B, C, and C, then I should get a product expectation value. Okay, good. So then I have to talk about the actual measurements. The actual measurements are POVMs, right? So collections of operators that are non-negative and sum to identity, so a non-commutative resolution of identity. And they describe the measurements of Alice, the measurements of Bob, the measurements of Charlie. They should all commute, and they should reproduce the empirical distribution when evaluated on the state. Okay, so now we have a statement of the problem. I want to, given PAB alpha, beta, gamma, x, y, z, I want to decide whether there is such a model for it. So now let's go through this mess of math and highlight which bits are easy and which bits are difficult. And in particular, I want to highlight three problems, three things that could make your day bad. Okay, so the first is this existential quantifier over algebras. Yeah, you get up in the morning and you have to solve an existential problem over observable algebras. These algebras are horrible things. They're extremely complicated. Yeah, they are not, you know, the possibilities that exist are in no way classified. You know, you can say, oh, maybe there's an infinite dimensional system, but that doesn't even begin to describe the problems, right? So there are algebras that do not, that are infinite dimensional, but they do not correspond to the bounded operators on L2. Yeah, so not, you know, a harmonic oscillator observable algebra or something like this. So we have to learn how to reason about observable algebras, okay? So the second problem is the factorization constraint, which is nonlinear in the state. Yeah, because, you know, these hierarchies, these SVP hierarchies, they have linear constraints, and that is nonlinear. So how to deal with that? And then there is, and it turns out these two problems we can deal with. And then there is another problem that really, you know, made our life much worse in the past, you know, I don't know, 1.5 years, is, let's go back to Bob. Bob's system factorizes into two subsystems. No, again, one receiving the message from the left, one receiving the message from the right. And the factorization constraint is phrased with respect to that subdivision. And that subdivision, as I will explain later, that is causing problems that we sometimes know how to solve and sometimes actually don't know how to solve. So that's why there is no answer to the question in my headline. All right. Good. So now you know the problem. You know kind of which pain points to watch out for. Let me now tell you what I mean by polynomial optimization. Okay, so the first problem is, okay, so we now have to talk about these objects and we want to put them into a computer. So now we have a bit of a tension because, for example, these observable algebras are super infinite dimensional things. You know, they are countable, but that's the, you know, have a, like a countable dense set or something, but this is the most redeeming feature. And we have to reason about them in a finitary way somehow. We need like a finitary way of specifying them so that we can get them into a computer. And we know very little about these observable algebras, I have no idea. So the one thing that we do know is that the global observable algebra, it certainly has to contain the POVMs. No? We need the POVMs to even state our problem. And so now there's maybe two ways for how to proceed. Like as an applied person, you say, okay, maybe I have to optimize over all possible algebras. But as a pure mathematician, you would say, maybe there's one universal object that describes all possible algebras that contain these POVMs. Yeah, and there is. And so that's the point of view we want to adopt. So there is what is called a universal C star algebra with generators, symbols that correspond to the POVMs, and relations. And now you list all the like non-negativity constraints and equality constraints that you may want to have. Yeah? And what do I mean by universal C star algebra? So now if you're a pure mathematician, you will immediately know what that means. If you're an applied person, close your eyes and listen to me. It is the smallest C star algebra such that every algebra with these properties embeds into the universal one. Yeah? So it's the one object, the smallest object that contains all possible solutions. Okay, so that's the kind of object we will work with. Here we just use the POVMs as generators, but of course we can also use more generators, put in more relations, whatever. We now know how to talk about algebras. We give generators and relations and work with the universal algebra, the universal object subject to these conditions. Okay.
Question.
Yeah.
Just to be clear, we're talking about all possible POVMs on system A, all possible POVMs?
No, we are talking here about the POVMs that actually enter the problem description only.
Oh.
Right, yeah. So these are the only ones. The only thing we know about the algebra is that for every measurement setting and every outcome, there has to be a POVM element. It's the only thing I know. So this is, you know, our starting point. Sometimes we enter, like in inflation, you put more in, like, hypothetical copies. That's fine, you can do it. I just wanted to motivate this construction, but I have no way of talking about every POVM in the algebra. It's a big algebra. There's going to be a lot of POVMs, so that is too big an object.
So for every specific choice of triple POVMs, there's a corresponding universal C-star algebra, and so you sort of want to...
Well, I'm not quite sure what you mean by specific choice. These are just symbols. You know, these are just symbols. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are not... Yeah, so I say I want an algebra that contains a symbol A alpha X, such that it is positive, such that if I sum of all the alpha, I get identity. Identity I also put in, such that they commute if they belong to different systems. But I don't write out like a matrix or something, you know. I can't, because, of course, in the end, these will live on super infinite dimensional spaces. So, all right, so I guess my answer is kind of in the middle. It's not all POVMs in these algebras. These are way too many. But it's also not specific ones. I can't even talk about them. I just want to say, computer, please work with the smallest algebra that contains POVMs ABC with these conditions. And then the computer will go, yeah, that's what I will tell you next. All right. So here's where I'm interfacing to the talk with Lawrence. So I will now tell you what the kind, like with these preparations, I will now tell you what the kind of problem is that Lawrence can solve. Okay. So now let's forget about causality for a second and state it more abstractly. So the input to the problems you can give to Lawrence is a bunch of generators, GI. These are formal objects that, you know, will correspond to concrete operators later, but I don't know which operators now. Yeah? I can put relations, and what I do is I take the generators and I form a non-commutative polynomial in these generators, some word in the generators, for example, yeah, and then I can add them up, and that will later correspond to operator products. And so every j is an element in this universal algebra, and I can demand that it be non-negative. Yeah? So I only want to talk about algebras where these polynomials, non-commutative polynomials, are non-negative. So these are the kind of constraints I can impose. Then if I can impose non-negativity constraints, I can also impose equality constraints. Yeah? And so these are the kind of input data that specifies the universal C-star algebra. Then I do something new, because also we need to have polynomial constraints in the state. So that is new now. So what I'm describing here is just a fancy way for talking about the NPA hierarchy. Now I do something in addition. Namely, I give polynomials PK in states evaluated at words of the generators. That's very easy, but very hard for me to say so that it makes sense to you. I'm not sure whether you're following. Let me actually scroll back and give you the example, because then, you know, I want to say stuff like this. Yeah, so that's a polynomial in the state, and it's evaluated on polynomials in the generators. Yeah, and so there are non-commutative polynomials inside, because that's an operator algebra, but these are just normal, honest to God, elementary school polynomials on the outside. Yeah, so that's kind of, we are marrying non-commutative and commutative polynomial optimization here. Okay, so if you have this data, if you have generators and relations and polynomials, then what Lawrence can do for you is he can output an infinite hierarchy of semi-definite programs that minimizes one polynomial in a state subject to polynomial constraints in the state, where the minimum is computed over the state space of the universal C-star algebra. Okay, so I hope you're, you know, adequately impressed by that. So it is, so this is kind of a new primitive, I think, like a different way to think about the kind of problems that inflation solves asymptotically, right? So if you, instead of writing down, you know, inflation diagrams, they're good for, I think, concrete witnesses, but if you want to analyze the asymptotic behavior, I think you should phrase it in this language, namely specify your algebra using generators and relations, specify your constraints if they're polynomial in the state, don't worry. And these are the things you can solve, and you don't have to worry anymore about how they're being solved, because Lawrence does it for you. All right, good. Are you kind of semi-happy? Now I can, okay, yeah?
Sorry, just a very naive question, but what is the strengthening of this result compared to the previous work on non-commutative polynomial optimization?
Yeah, that we have polynomials in the state.
No. Polynomials in the state.
Yeah. So if I go back, this thing you couldn't say in NPO.
Okay.
And now we can also say it. Yeah. And in half an hour, people, you know, Lawrence will tell you how that works. And there is yeah. So we did it last year. There's another paper early this year by some Lacerre students and friends that did the same in a weirdly dual way to us. So it's very interesting. So two people came up with the same hierarchy. So it's very interesting, I think. Okay, but that's not my talk. That's Lawrence's talk. Yeah, okay. So okay. So now two of these traffic lights have, you know, we are go for launch. Yeah, propellant loading has started. Let's see how many minutes it will carry us into the flight before we break up. Okay, so we can talk about these observables. We can handle the non-polynomial constraints. I will now tell you that, you know, this thing still causes problems. All right, now, but what you can do now is you can now understand the title of my presentation, like toward the end of my talk. Namely, now we have a tool, namely this doubly polynomial, commutative and non-commutative polynomial optimization. And the question is causal, are these causal problems actually contained in this class of problems? And the answer is, I don't know. The answer is, I know a little bit, of course. Okay, so let's see what is the issue. I kind of alluded to it before, but I would say it again. I will say it in three different ways, because I think that's kind of the central thing that, you know, kept us awake in the past 2 years. There is now a hockey stick Unicode character. So if you want to label an equation to refer back to it, you can use a hockey stick to do that. All right, so here's the difficulty. The difficulty is now I need you to concentrate, because that is the conceptual difficulty, like all the math, forget it. Now comes the actual conceptual difficulty, is that this factorization constraint involves operators, BA and BC, that need not lie in the algebra generated by Bob's observables. You know, I would say it in three different ways, because it's a bit abstract, but it's really the... Yeah, so what do we know about this algebra? I said, well, it contains the things that are being observed, right? But the observations of Bob, they are entangled across his subpartition. And if I look at the algebraic closure of their measurements, they might not contain any product operators at all. But it is these product operators with respect to which the factorization constraints are stated. All right, so here's my second way of saying the problem. It is unclear how the observables lie relative to the locality structure that defines the causal problem. I don't know how that works in general. And finally, because Lawrence can now do non-polynomial optimization, we could impose that constraint, easy peasy, not a problem, if we knew which operators to impose it on, you know, or how to express them in terms of things that we can measure. And we don't know that in general. Okay. So now, if you followed me to this point, my main part is done, and I can just kind of like, no, I don't know. I don't know how it works time-wise. You stop me at some point. I have now two mini things I can, yeah, two solutions. The first solution is general. It works in general causal structures, but it's a bit of a hack. That's our first paper from late 21, which also Lawrence gave a talk about here, which when we didn't really understand it yet so well, I think, you know, we can talk about it much better now. And the second one is a very new paper, inspired by a publication by Marc Olivier and Jianling Su, where for linear scenarios, or well, at least for the bilocal scenario, we can now construct the subdivision without any hacks. So this we can solve, and we have this convergent SVP hierarchy, and everything is beautiful. Okay, the first one is easy to explain, but it's inelegant. The second one is not so easy to explain, but it's very elegant. Let me take 1 minute for each, and it will only be a rough outline for the second. Okay, so the hack is super easy. It's kind of, you know, it's embarrassingly easy. I apologize, sorry for that. So the top-down approach doesn't work. So it means, top-down, it means like we have the total, you know, we have these entangled measurements of Bob, and we want to like break them down and write them as, you know, in terms of these local subsystems, and we don't know how to do it. So we can't express these local algebras of Bob in terms of observables. So we just turn things around. We just introduce generators for these parts of Bob's algebra manually, and then we demand that the POVMs can be expressed in terms of these generators, so that we can just do, and it works. Obviously, it's, you know, kind of straightforward from here, but it introduces a rank constraint, because I have to put it into the SDP solver. How, you know, I have to say, please find local operators such that the POVM element can be expressed this way, and I have to put in R the rank you know, the Schmidt rank, kind of quantifying how big, how entangled the measurement is. And that is not very natural. So that is the part of my headline where I don't know whether we can get around this in general. But the new thing is, okay, now the final thing, the new thing is that there are situations now where we can solve that. Hooray. And okay, and so here's the main technical result. In the bilocal scenario, this counterfactual factorization constraint that is stated with respect to these counterfactual things that Bob could have measured but didn't, can be replaced by independence just involving Alice and Charlie's system. And we don't even have to talk about Bob's system at all. And this is okay because, you know, that's a polynomial in the state, and it involves elements of algebras we know how to talk about. Yeah, A and C are the algebra generated by Alice's and Charlie's observables. Yeah. All right. Good. So and so that's the technical result that that, you know, in bilocal it's much easier. Yeah. And I wanted to say for linear change and for trees, and Lawrence has been looking at these, but kind of like on the flight here, this like generalization kind of fell apart. So I don't know whether. So we can do it for the bilocal, and we can't currently do it for anything else. Okay. Good. And yeah, I don't know. I have two slides on the proof idea, which are totally insufficient to actually explain it, but I can explain you the one main point is namely, how do we get this bloody algebra back, this local subdivision of Bob's observables? This I can explain, and the rest maybe I just skip. Okay, so the proof idea, okay, so it's one of two. So how do we recover the subdivision of Bob's system into something coming from the left and something coming from the right? And let's turn things around. Let's assume we already solved the problem, and let's look at, you know, how we can talk about the solution. And then let's phrase it abstractly in ways that only involve algebraic constructions. Yeah? And then we can impose those, and they turn out to be enough. Okay. So assume now there is a textbook quantum model given for this bilocal correlation. So we have actually Hilbert spaces with Alice, the two Bob systems, and Charlie. And the wave function that we now assume exists factorizes with respect to, you know, this cut through the middle of Bob, right? In the Bob room, we are cutting up Bob here. Okay, and let's also assume for the sake of the argument that psi AB, so the state connecting Alice to Bob, is maximally entangled. That's just for convenience. Then, okay, so then, now we do some elementary quantum information, like first year quantum information thing. So then, look, Alice can act on the joint state, but Bob can also act on the joint state. And if it's maximally entangled, anything Alice can do, Bob can also do. You can move every operator through a maximally entangled state and have it act on the other side. And these two actions commute. No, because they act on different systems. So now, if I have a state like this, I can look at the Hilbert space generated by that space, by Alice's and Bob's observables. And Bob's action is the commutant of Alice's action on that Hilbert space. Ha! That should make you all very happy. Because commutant is something algebraic that I can use. And so, all right, okay, so then the operators on Bob's left half is just described as the commutant of Alice's algebra. Alice's algebra we know, commutant we know, in the operators, you know, yeah, living on the left-hand side. And this turns out we can also do. Okay, so so that's the main idea is, you know, to use this characterization of Bob's half as, you know, the Hilbert space that Alice can generate by acting on her half of the state, and on this Hilbert space, the commutant of what Alice can do. So that's the main idea. And then you do a bit of GNS magic, but maybe I leave it here. And it's probably, anyway, not the kind of thing that you can convey in a morning talk. yeah. So the one thing is that we, okay, maybe I say the one conceptual thing. See, I assume we start with a tensor product. But I told you before, tensor products are nana, we don't have them. But sometimes we get them for free. And this is the case here. So if you have a state that factorizes in this way, then this GNS magic construction that takes an algebra and gives you back a Hilbert space actually returns to you an honest-to-God textbook tensor product Hilbert space. So the factorization constraint gives us a tensor product Hilbert space, and then we can play this commutant trick that I alluded to before, and everything works out. Okay. So here's a summary. So if you write down any algebra at any set of polynomial constraints in the state, in addition to in the generators, which is and so the polynomials in the state is a new thing, then Lorentz can turn it into a convergent SVP hierarchy. You're welcome. but it's still not, I think it's a good way of trying to, you know, attack, it's a good primitive for attacking the completeness problem, but it's still not obvious, even if you can do that, whether this kind of model captures causal optimization. And the reason is, you know, that the independence constraints here are kind of formulated in a counterfactual way, formulated in terms of observables that Bob could have measured, but they might not be in the algebra generated by the POVM that Bob is actually measuring. So thank you. Whoop, there's a thank you slide. Thank you. Right.
Questions?
You talked about generalizing it beyond bilocality.
Yeah.
What about just to a star scenario, let's say, so like one Bob, three Alice's.
Yeah, I think you have like the more painful dialogue account you get from Lorentz there.
Works. Yes. So the star also works with exactly the same construction.
Okay. So then I think I would want to ask about generalization, but we can do it offline.
Okay.
Last one, technical question. At the very, one of your last slides, the proof idea.
Yeah.
You use the GNS construction to get a tensor product, which mm-hmm. you can see, but wouldn't you want to consider the commutant of the A algebra in a larger Hilbert space that included B?
No, that's exactly the point. We don't need, this is actually very interesting. So we don't need the B space at all. We don't need it. So let's say you have HA, and again, it's where's the white chalk? There's color chalk. Here. This also has some interesting corollaries.
I'm just gonna turn on the light.
Okay. So let's say you have that. You have this in the Hilbert space associated with Alice, and that in the Hilbert space, sorry, I shouldn't call it beta, I should call it gamma, by Charlie, right? And each of those, they, both Alice and Bob can act on this, and both Alice and Bob can act on this.
Go to Charlie.
Ah, yes, that's right, thank you. Both, you know, let's stay here. Alice and Bob. So now, Bob can also do much more, of course, because there is also Bob's Hilbert space, I just didn't consider it. But whatever Bob can do more does not actually enter the correlations here.
You sort of use the A Hilbert space as proxy for the Hilbert space Bob has access to, because you think of it sort of through the maximum entanglement.
Yes.
Every action that Bob takes, I'm going to model as an action.
That's right. And everything that Bob can do beyond that does not enter the final correlations. Okay. Bob can do much more, but doesn't. And if you can see, there's also a lack of symmetry here. So here, if you're, of course, you know, you're well familiar with all these algebraic things. So here we have representations of A and representations of C, but just as a quantum channel acting on B. And the quantum channel mods out all the thing that Bob can do that does not, you know, influence Alice and Charlie's Hilbert space. So for the correlations, it doesn't matter. We don't need to model it. And for example, this has the following corollary. Let's say that Alice, the algebra generated by Alice and Charlie is finite dimensional, but the algebra generated by Bob's observable is infinite dimensional. Then it doesn't matter, because Bob enters the picture, these correlations, only in as much as he can influence Alice and Charlie systems. So all the infinitely many degrees of freedom, they get traced over by lambda automatically. Our construction does that. And so you get a finite dimensional model out. And that's good, because for finite dimensional models, we have many more equivalences, you know, of, you know, tensor product and commutators being the same. And so in this line scenario, all you have to demand is that the ends of the line are well behaved, and the middle can be a priori as complex as you want, because the complexity doesn't enter. Yeah, because you only care for correlations. So yeah, that's right. So the entire point is that there is no B here, and that B only indirectly appears in the way that you can move things to a maximally entangled state. Yeah. So there is actually, like in the algebraic, in these yellow books, there is a mathematical theory describing this kind of moving operation through a maximally entangled state. And we always live in fear, Lawrence and me, that we actually have to learn that. And so far, we got away without learning it. And so this moving operation through a maximally entangled state is called Tomita Takasaki modular theory. and it's, I'm sure it's beautiful. But I don't, you know, so far we haven't, you know, well, you know, maybe we have to learn it at some point. Okay, good question.
I have another question, but I want to open it up to everyone else. I can embed the classical causal question in the quantum question just by choosing my algebras to be commutative.
Yeah.
So then you go from this, you know, non-commutative polynomial optimization to one that's commutative for the states and the measurements.
Yeah.
So first off, I'm guessing that like the innovation, what you do is sort of dealing with that non-commutative aspect. And if you'd only had the commutative ones, we would have already known how to do that polynomial optimization. So I guess I'm just wondering, do you learn something about the classical problem by thinking about it this way?
I haven't learned anything about the classical problem by thinking about it this way, but this could be on me. I don't know. So I mean, classically, it's much easier because you can use Cavathiodori type arguments to tell you exactly what, you know, if everything is finite and the hidden algebras are also finite, you can bound the cardinality, so you have a concrete model. So this entire existential quantifier over algebras falls away. You don't even have it. So you're saving a lot of things. Yeah. One interesting thing is, as I said, you know, this double polynomial kind of optimization. So, you know, Lawrence worked it out after reading Marc Olivier's paper, but also there was simultaneously, and a little bit later, was, you know, a long paper by a bunch of mathematicians whom we'll meeting soon in May. They were all European, so they will, no, not all of them actually. So we'll meet and try to work it out. And so they come from, he's working with Lasserre, so these are Lasserre people. So these are classical people. And they are solving the same type of problems, but their SDP hierarchy is different from ours. And it's kind of funny. Should I say it, or are you going to say that?
I'm not going to focus very much.
Okay, so then I can say, because it really, you know, it's a sociological experiment. Okay, so everybody in the room here, not everybody, but a good chunk, is well acquainted with these NPO type hierarchies. No, I mean, you know it. And now you want to, get independence constraints. Independence constraints are polynomial. We don't know how to do that in the state, so we don't know how to do it. So what do you people do? You include copies and impose symmetry. And how does one derive independence from symmetry? Well, that's Definetti. Yeah. And so what we are doing, Lawrence and me, we are running an NPO hierarchy, and the commutative polynomial constraints we emulate by using your idea of duplication symmetry and proving a Definetti theorem to show that it actually converges. Now, the Klepp brothers, as I call them, because I can't remember all their names, the Klepp brothers, they come from the opposite direction. They know classical Lasserre polynomial optimization, which is optimizing over algebraic varieties, so objects specified by polynomial equations, and optimizing polynomial there. So for them, commutative polynomials are normal. And they have to work hard how to get these non-commutative polynomials of the algebras inside of there, and they have to put the constraint that rho is a state, so that rho evaluated on a positive operator as a positive number. And so what they do is their outer loop is a Lasserre hierarchy that encodes the classical polynomials, and inside the Lasserre hierarchy, they put extra constraints that make the object states. So we run NPO on the outside and have this Definetti subroutine that takes care of the classical polynomials, and they run the classical polynomials on the outside and have a subroutine that makes these object states. So that, you know, that took us like a month to read their paper and understand it, but now I think we kind of can talk to each other. Yeah, I think theirs is more efficient than ours, you know. All right, good.
Okay, thanks very much.